Groups and a School, Monday, 21st June 1982. In connection with our theme for the week, death, last Saturday we considered death as we see it close to us, namely in our own lives, in the life of the organic world and the planet itself. And we also considered in some detail what scientists consider is likely to happen to the universe as a whole if it goes on expanding forever and ever. And we saw that the ultimate end of that would be an eternal silence in the void, which relatively to our ideas and vision and understanding means an absolute death, annihilation altogether. There is, of course, the other view that if this expansion process of the universe does not go on forever, but it comes to, it slows down, comes to a stop, and then reverses. If it slows down, comes to a stop, then it will have to reverse because of the forces at play. And then that process can go on in, out, and so on. Just go on cyclically forever and ever. Those are the two alternatives. But you may remember I mentioned that scientists say this as a result of their work with their particular state of consciousness. Supposing one could, one's consciousness could undergo a complete transformation, then something else may well come on the scene. And that would be quite a different story altogether. But for us here, we all know that this body, which we call ourselves, will necessarily die. There is no single body, human body, or any animal body, which does not die as such. And the idea of death is very much tinged with the idea of annihilation. And since it is directly related to the life and death of the physical body as such, let us consider carefully the body this morning. Each and every person starts life by identifying self with the physical body. For the infant and for the little child, the word I represents the body. This is me, as the child would say and think. And this consciousness is so powerful any other person, he or she, is also just a body, nothing else. All other bodies for the child are different from and not related to my body, except insofar as any particular other body, but especially a parent, is a source of food, comfort and pleasure, or a controlling and protecting, and a rewarding or punishing agent. Then the little child is aware of a relationship, but everybody else is totally and complete somebody else and has no relationship with me. That's as far as the infant state is concerned. Self-consciousness, therefore, starts completely as body consciousness. And the psychical reactions of like or dislike, wanting or not wanting, dominate life. But even in early childhood, when seeing death, as when an insect is squashed, or a bird is killed, or a domestic pet dies, that appears to the child as complete annihilation. It's dead, it's finished once and for all. Before long, the child comes to know that people die. Sooner or later, it asks, will I also die? Then, the greatest fear in our lives, the fear of death, arises, and it becomes more and more intense as the child sees and hears of other people dying, sees funerals, sees death enacted upon the TV or whatever it is, and the question arises, what happens to me after I die and to others after they die? Associated with it is the question, where was I before I was born? Now, the importance of these two questions lies here. The questions imply the underlying unconscious assumption of the I, the self, as a permanent identifiable entity. A permanent identifiable entity. Otherwise, obviously, the question, where was I before I was born, or what happens to me after I'm dead, couldn't possibly arise. The I or the me somehow is a sort of a consciousness of a permanent identifiable self. And it starts right from childhood, and this consciousness of the self, the individual separate self, as a permanent identifiable entity, never disappears right through life. Look at the way we cling to life. We want to live whatever happens. Sometimes people, in a moment of annoyance or whatever it is, or suffering, they say, oh, I wish I were dead. If you suddenly presented them with death, they would say, oh, no, I want to live, I'm going to live. And they'll do everything possible to continue to live. The parent or friend or priest or teacher will answer these questions, where was I before I was born and what happens to me after I'm dead? They will answer in accordance with their own conditioning, their own beliefs, their wishful thinking, etc. Extremely rarely will an honest answer such as, I do not know, be given. Exceptionally few people have clear or true perceptions in connection with this question. Almost every person in the world is self-conscious in terms of all people, all over the world, we are conscious in terms of I am I and not any other person or creature or object. This is the important part, and not any other person or creature. Whilst in childhood I am I is restricted to the body, by adulthood other elements have been added on to the body, such as mind, psyche, soul, spirit, call it what you will, as the result of conditioning by upbringing and education, and the influence of the social and cultural heritage. But these words do not have a vivid living significance for the masses. After all, one has only to look at oneself and one's own responses to every stimulus in life, whether it comes from outside or whether it comes from within. It is a very personal response. I am I, and it is associated with the body as such. The ideas of soul or spirit and so on are not there. And the word mind simply means my thoughts and feelings and emotions and moods and so on, which is not really mind, but just the psychical expressions of a mental of energy at work through the body. But then people don't know that, they just use these words very vaguely. A minority of people are aware that we as existential beings are psychophysical beings. And of that small minority, only a tiny percentage are awake to or efficiently conscious of the meaning and activity of mind or soul or spirit on us and their relationship to the body. Worst of all, the masses regard the mind and spirit as something vague and shadowy, loosely associated with the body, something unreal relatively to the body, which is very real. Feelings and thoughts are also very real, but they really belong mostly to the realm of what we call matter, and not to an immaterial realm. It's an extraordinary thing that thought is material, thought as such, because what we call thought is just a string of words. At our present stage, we are quite ignorant of how body is related to mind and spirit. We are ignorant of the fact of the unitary wholeness of our being, and indeed of the identity of body, mind, spirit. We use three different words, but in actuality, in ultimate reality, these three words represent only one thing, one reality, that is all. But we separate them because our consciousness functions in that limited way, in that separative way. This implies that if we fully know any one of them, we fully know all of them. If you fully know what is called the spirit, you will also know body and mind. Fully know the mind, you'll also know spirit and body. Fully know the body, which is the easiest to know for us as we are at present in the world, living bodily. If we fully know the body, we will fully know mind and spirit too. So let us consider this morning, briefly, very briefly of course, the body. I say very briefly because it's impossible to exhaust the subject of the body in an hour or a week or some years, in fact. There is so much to know. Man's primary interest is his own body. Now think of that carefully. The fact remains that we are all concerned with the body as such all day, right through the day. We can't avoid it, because our waking awareness is entirely restricted to a bodily awareness, and associated with that bodily awareness, what we call a psychical or mental phenomena and so forth. Several sciences in the world have been born out of the body as such. For example, in ancient days, when a hunter or a warrior slew some animals or his enemies, and he wanted to sort of recount to his tribe how many he had slain. He started off like that, using his fingers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He didn't know the words 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in his own language, but he had 5 fingers to represent that. And out of that primordial origin arose arithmetic and all the rest of it, you see. And you know what mathematics today is, what stage it has come to. Then again, man observed the different seasons every year, and also the fact of women's periods being associated with the moon's phases. So, observing the moon's phases and the movement of the stars in the sky and how they came back to the same position the following year and so forth, the science of astronomy was born. You see how these were all born out of the body. Then again, plants and seeds for food, their medicinal properties and so forth. And all that was the beginning of the science of botany and medicine. Aristotle made some considerable researches along these lines. He may, in a sense, be called the father of all science, because he was the first to get his students, as well as himself, to observe carefully the different species, their behavior, their activities, and so forth, and tabulate them all carefully in a scientific manner. He pigeonholed everything very carefully. Aristotle flourished, of course. He was born in 384 BC and died in 322. And then there was that very great man, Hippocrates, who flourished in the 5th century BC. We have to this day the Hippocratic Oath, which the medical student takes, and so forth. And he flourished between 460 and 376 BC. Some say that he died in 359, which would make him 101 years old at his death, but it's uncertain. In the 16th century, there was a very distinguished scientist, Vesalius, whose treatise entitled De Humanis Corporis Fabricia, on the structure of the human body, in 1543 marks the beginning of modern medicine as such, medical science as such. He was a great anatomist, and I believe it was Sir William Osler who, in one of his copies of that book, put down, "Here begins true medical science." The body expresses man's qualities and powers of mind and behavior, and each man bears on his face the description of his body and psyche. It's extraordinarily true. We say appearances are deceptive. It would be more correct to say we do not know how to read appearances. But he who has released perfect insight, the power of perfect insight, and can see everything for what it actually is, if any such person is present here and looks at me, he will know exactly what I am without making any mistake. Appearances are not deceptive. It is our capacity to interpret the appearance which is the difficulty. The skin can destroy microbes on its surface. It is impermeable to water and gases, adjusts to climatic conditions, is durable due to several layers of cells which endlessly multiply, and it is sensitive to pain, pressure and temperature. The blood, which is a very important part of our body, consisting of approximately 30,000 million red corpuscles and 50,000 million white corpuscles, the leukocytes, carries nourishment and removes waste products and repairs organs. Its red and white cells are suspended in blood plasma, which contains acids, proteins, sugars, which are especially necessary for the brain. The brain must be constantly supplied with sugar and oxygen. Deprive the brain for even 5 minutes of oxygen and that means death. 3.5 minutes is the usual limit with most people. But if it goes beyond 3.5 and gets to about 5 minutes, you're dead as a dodo. Also, the blood stream contains fats and the secretions of all glands and tissues. The blood also contains antibodies, which are necessary for combating harmful microbes. The blood plasma has fibrinogen, which turns into fibrin in case of a hemorrhage and stops the bleeding. Clot gets formed and it stops the bleeding. The entire body is traversed by this stream of nutritive substances. The digestive membranes act as a filter and also as a chemical factory. Mucous membranes covering our inner surfaces secrete and absorb large quantities of fluids. Now, the cells of the body allow digested foods to enter the body, resist penetration of bacteria swarming in the digestive tract. Dangerous enemies such as viruses in the nose and pharynx, streptococci and diphtheria microbes in the tonsils, bacilli of typhoid fever and dysentery in the intestines. These are all tackled by the body itself, up to a point, of course. Soundness of respiratory and digestive membranes largely governs the body's resistance to infectious diseases, governs its equilibrium, its effectivity, and intellectual attitude. Living tissue in a flask, if you take living tissue and put it into a flask, it needs 2,000 times its own volume of fluids in order not to be poisoned by its waste products in a few days. The average-sized body would need 200,000 quarts of nutritive fluid. But on account of the marvelous perfection of the apparatus responsible for the circulation of the blood, its wealth of nutritive substances and constant elimination of waste from ducts, of waste products, our tissues can live in just 6 or 7 quarts of fluid, which is blood and lymph, instead of 200,000. This is the marvel of the body. Mother Nature knows her job better than any human being still knows. Our conduct largely depends on the state of our circulatory apparatus, and all human activities are regulated by the condition of the nutritive blood. The remarkable efficiency of the functioning of the kidneys and lungs permits the fluid medium required by living tissues to be so limited and the body to be so compact and agile. Now, the ductless glands, the endocrines as they are called, synthesize thyroxine, adrenaline and insulin, which are so necessary for our continued safe, healthy existence. They are true chemical transformers, producing substances indispensable for the nutrition of cells and organs and physiological and psychological activities. This business point about the psychological activities is very important in connection with the endocrines. To endocrines is due the existence of the body with its manifold activities. Each organ possesses multiple activities. It does not possess only one specific activity. It has multiple activities. It extends by means of its secretions over the whole organism and takes part in almost all the events of the body. It's a strange fact that each single important organ does that with the whole organism. An organ is not made like a house, where you collect the bricks and the wood and whatever is necessary and so forth. Nor is it a mere collection of cells. It is born from one cell, as if you take the analogy of a house, as if a magic brick manufactured all the bricks without architect's drawings, bricklayers and so on. This magic brick also produces the window panes, roof slates, in fact, the entire house. An organ is engendered by cells which seem to know the future, synthesized from blood plasma, the building material, and even the workers. This is the marvel of the living body. Consider how the entire body emerges from just one fertilized cell, that is all. And everything else comes out of that. This wonder-working body is extremely robust. It adapts to arctic cold, tropical heat, resists starvation, fatigue, hardships. I don't know how many of us realize that man, out of all the creatures of the animal kingdom, is the hardiest animal of all. His endurance comes from the elasticity of the tissues. This is a very important point to remember. It's the quality of elasticity of the tissues which makes for man's power of endurance. For the tenacity of the tissues and their property of growing instead of wearing out, and their strange power of adaptive change. In illness, the body preserves the same unity as in health. It is sick as a whole. It is not sick in just one part. Now, modern doctors have begun to realize this fact. And the old idea of treating any particular part which is in difficulty as a separate thing all on its own is giving place to the concept and practice of treating the whole body, but with special attention to the particular part, so that they are recognizing that the body is an organic whole. In fact, it is an organic, it is a psychophysical organism. The cerebral centers consist partly of fluids containing the gland and tissue secretions that diffuse through the entire body. Thus, every organ is present in the cerebral cortex. That is the importance of the cerebral cortex. That's why it's the lord and master of the whole body. The psyche and the body mutually influence each other. Personality is modified by diseases of the liver, stomach, intestines, and so on, whose cells discharge into the bodily fluids chemicals that react upon mental functions. And we know that envy, hate, fear, and so on produce organic changes and disease, worry, moral suffering, particularly the activity of conscience, and emotions affect dilatation or contraction of small arteries through vasomotor nerves, accompanied by changes in blood circulation. Pleasure produces a flush on the face, and fear turns one quite white. Psychological states stimulate or stop gland secretions or modify their chemical constitution. Moral shock may cause marked changes in blood, and thought can give rise to organic lesions. The instability of modern life, agitation, make for nervous and organic disorders of the stomach and intestines, defective nutrition, and the passage of intestinal microbes into the circulatory apparatus. This sort of trouble is almost unknown largely in primitive tribes, in those whose life is simpler and unanxious. It is our modern civilized life that introduces all these disturbances. Those who are inwardly tranquil are immune, on the whole, from nervous and organic disorders. Our organs improvise means for meeting every new situation and cooperate with and adjust themselves to others, and they to it through a correlation of the organic fluids and the nervous system. Each part seems to know the present and future needs of the whole and acts accordingly. It's one of the most extraordinary things about the body. We, in our ordinary everyday waking consciousness, we are quite unaware of how much the body knows. The body cells know just what to do and how to do it. You know how they say that when a rider loses his way in the forest, he just lets the horse use his horse sense and take him out of the forest into safety. Similarly, the body has a remarkable body sense about itself, which would really put our conscious outlook and knowledge to shame, because it is so perfect. The body perceives the remote as well as the present. For example, in pregnancy, when it is coming to its end, the tissues of the vulva and vagina are invaded by fluids, become soft and extensible, and allow easy passage of the fetus. Also, the mammary glands multiply their cells and begin to function before confinement, ready and waiting to feed the child. Obviously, a preparation for a future event. The body just does this all on its own. What a perfect welfare state is the body. During the entire history of the embryo, the tissues prepare for the future. And the life of the embryo recapitulates the whole process of evolution which has ended up with man. It's the most extraordinary thing. And this is specially tied up with the development of the brain, which we must note a few points now about that master controller of the body, namely the brain with its approximately 13,000 million cells. Think, 13,000 million cells just inside one's nut. Most extraordinary. The whole body consists of, to use the old English numeration, 15 billion cells. But now that we are also adopting the continental and American method, we would have to call it 15 trillion cells. You see. The brain, with its 13,000 million cells, plays the basic biological role of keeping us adjusted to unpredictable events in the outside world and keeping us alive by balancing the processes of birth and decay. These have top priority. Everything else either helps in carrying them out or else waits its turn. For example, it controls the level of blood sugar, breathing, heartbeat, the body's temperature of 98.4 Fahrenheit, and it acts as the headquarters of the most elaborate communications network ever devised. The sense organs are the brain's informers. They are our windows to the outside world. Different areas in the brain receive the impressions coming through the senses. The interpretation of the nerve signals depends on the place in the brain at which they arrive. If they arrive at the wrong place, we would misinterpret the impulse, the stimulus. For example, if listening to fast music, the nerve signals somehow got switched to the wrong line in the brain and arrived at the visual areas of the cortex, you'd see the music as a mad rush of flashing lights, vivid colors, moving forms, a sort of crosstalk talk between nerve fibers. If the current escaping from a touch fiber were to reach a sound fiber, you might hear crashing noises when you bumped your elbow. You won't feel get a sensation of pain on your elbow, but you'd hear crashing noises. Like all our organs, the brain has evolved, increasing in complexity and information content over millions of years. Its structure reflects all the stages through which it has passed. It evolved from the inside outwards. Deep inside, the oldest part is the brain stem, just up to there, you see. Conducting biological, basic biological functions, heartbeat and respiration. That's what the brain stem controls. The higher functions of the brain evolved in three stages successively. First, capping the brain stem is what is called the R complex, capital R dash complex, the seat of aggression, ritual, territoriality, and social hierarchy. It evolved hundreds of millions of years ago in our reptilian ancestors, the crocodile brain in us. It is still there. That's what scientists call it, the crocodile brain. Second, surrounding this crocodile brain is the limbic system or mammalian brain that evolved tens of millions of years ago in ancestors who were mammals but not yet primates. It is the major source of our moods and emotions of concern and care for the young. Lastly, you will appreciate why I have quite arbitrarily, of course, said we don't have mind as yet. We have psyche. It is this universal energy mind which, interacting with the body, has produced, and it is rooted materially in the brain and the ductus glands and the blood as the most important physical agents for the manifestation of what we call our psychical life, you see. It is, yes. Third, on the outside, living in uneasy truth with the more primitive brains. Oh, did I tell you that the mammalian brain is the major source of our moods and emotions and of our concern and care for the young? You know how all mammals, they have this natural care for the young. There comes the stage when the young very quickly get separated. In the human kingdom, it lasts longest of all. On the outside, living in uneasy truce with the more primitive brains beneath is the cerebral cortex evolved millions of years ago in our primate ancestors. Not the monkeys. Don't say that we are descended from the monkeys. The monkey tribe, the orangs and such like, are our cousins. They are not our true ancestors. And some of them are nicer than a good many humans. It is in the cortex that we have consciousness. The cortex comprises more than two-thirds of the brain mass. The mass of the brain is roughly 3 pounds. It is the seat of intuition as well as critical analysis. You know this business of the right and the left sides of the brain and so on. Of ideas and inspirations, reading, writing, mathematics, music, and so on. It regulates our conscious lives. It distinguishes us from all other animal species. It is the seat of our humanity. Civilization is a product of the cerebral cortex. Our brains have about 100 billion, that is 100,000 million neurons. And it's rather interesting that the number of stars, the approximate number of stars in our particular galaxy, the Milky Way, is 100,000 million. And we have 100,000 million neurons in our brains. Many neurons, each of these neurons, have thousands of connections with their neighbors. In the cortex, there are 10 to the power 14, that is in modern universal numeration, that's 100 trillion such connections. The information content of the human brain, expressed in bits, is comparable to the number of connections. Now, if all these information bits, 100 trillion information bits, were written out in the English language, even in précis form, would fill approximately 20 million volumes in the English language. Think what a library we carry about with us. Something which is composed of 20 million volumes of bits of information. The brain is indeed a vast place in a very tiny space. Our survey of the body so far is very elementary, of necessity. Very much more could be said, but we must move on. Man's body is a thing of wonder and marvel. Our Mother Earth took 4,500 million years, almost half the age of the universe, some would say a quarter, perhaps a quarter is nearer the fact, to evolve and develop this extraordinary body. Never say that the body is mere matter, nor depreciate the body. It is sacred. The living body, human body, is sacred. Pache Krishnamurti. For it is the living temple of the Most High. In the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, it is distinctly said, the body is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity. And it's very interesting, St. Paul says, know ye not that ye are the temple of the Most High. In fact, he says, of the Holy Ghost, the third person of the Trinity. It is a sin to depreciate the body, a greater sin to misuse it, especially its creative functions. Marriage and marital congress is a sacrament. But unfortunately, the whole human race has forgotten how to carry out marital congress. They carry it out as a matter of pleasure, as a matter of emotion, and so on. But if one knows how to make it a sacramental thing, the world would be a very different place altogether. There is information about that, but only very, very few know it. It is a very great sin to treat the body cruelly and to kill it. You'll notice that the outstanding commandment or advice given by all the great spiritual teachers is the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And the advice to abstain from all harming. Think of the profound, even transcendent significance of the statement in the Christian marriage service, with my body I thee love. Now you see what the body means really, what it signifies. It is in itself the totality, one's whole being. But we, after 3 or 4 million years on the globe, are conscious of the body merely as a body and not much more. Well, I think we'll have to stop there. Thank you.